Okay, thank you very much. Good evening. Welcome to the Copyright Society of the USA's 43rd annual Donald C. Brace Lecture. My name is Joe Salvo, and it's my honor as president of the Copyright Society to welcome you here to Fordham University's School of Law and to introduce tonight's honoree and speaker, Shira Perlmutter. For those of you that don't know, the Copyright Society is a member-run nonprofit organization. We are celebrating our 61st year, and lots and lots of activities that we sponsor. I would encourage those of you that are not familiar with us, go to our website, www.csusa.org, for a total schedule of everything that we're doing. Each year, the Society seeks to single out one of the leading thinkers, writers, scholars, practitioners, jurists, or policymakers in our field that has contributed to the understanding, discourse, and advancement of copyright, and to invite them here to New York to give the prestigious Brace Lecture. Past speakers are among some of the giants of copyright, and tonight's speaker is no exception. Shira Perlmutter, for those of you that may not know, currently serves as the Chief Policy Officer and Director for International Affairs for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. In that capacity, she serves as the policy advisor to the Undersecretary of Commerce for Intellectual Property and oversees a number of critical functions, including the administration and support for all domestic and international IP policy-related operations, like our trade and treaty obligations, through her oversight of the Office of Policy and External Affairs. Congressional and legislative engagement is carried out through the Office of Governmental Affairs. IP education and training through her involvement with the Global IP Academy. Global IP leadership through the IP Attaché Program. And economic analysis through the Chief Economist. Prior to joining the USPTO, Shira served over 5.5 years as the Executive Vice President of Global Legal Policy in London for the IFPI, the International Federation of Phonograph Industries, developing and coordinating worldwide IP positions on behalf of the recorded music industry, and representing the labels before various intergovernmental bodies, including the European Commission. And while some of us tend to spend our downtime in London doing such pedestrian things as visiting the London Eye or the Tower of London, while there, Shira also served as a lecturer at King's College at the University of London, as a research fellow at the Oxford Intellectual Property Research Center at the University of Oxford, as a trustee at the Munich Intellectual Property Law Center, as a co-chair of the European Commission's Digital Libraries Initiative and the Music Sound Working Group. And notably, as an American, she was one of 5 people appointed to the Copyright Expert Panel advising the UK government's Strategic Advisory Board for Intellectual Property Policy. She preceded that assignment in her role as Vice President and Associate General Counsel at Time Warner, Inc. here in New York City, the parent corporation, as many of you know, for the Time, Inc. publishing empire, Warner Brothers Studios, what was then the Warner Music Group, Time Warner Cable, and AOL, an extremely diverse set of IP clients with very differing agendas and needs, all of which she managed to successfully juggle. From May 1999 to September 2000, she was a consultant on issues relating to copyright and electronic commerce for the WIPO in Geneva, Switzerland. That position, in turn, was a direct outgrowth of Shira's serving as the very first Associate Register for Policy and International Affairs at the U.S. Copyright Office, appointed by our own Mary Beth Peters, the then-current Register of Copyrights, a position Shira held during the critical years of 1995 to 1999. It was in that role that I first met Shira, although I'm not sure you would remember, when I was asked by Dave Johnson, the then general counsel of Sony Music, to fly to Geneva, Switzerland, essentially to attend a cocktail party at some copyright thing, as I recall Dave referring to it. And as my wife Barbara can attest, I came home very excited, packed my ski boots, a very small duffel bag, figuring I would quickly hit the cocktail party, then duck out and get in a nice weekend of skiing in Switzerland after some light cocktail chatter at whatever this event was. Well, the copyright thing, of course. turned out to be the International Convention convened by WIPO in 1996 to modify the Berne Convention by coming up with a series of forward-looking rules to govern copyright protection in the digital age. And like many other people that came to Geneva that month, I became completely swept up in the excitement and the promise of this incredible gathering of the world's leading copyright experts, all gathered under one roof to determine the future of copyright. And there, as a lead member of the U.S. delegation representing the whole of U.S. copyright interests, sat Shira. And so I elbowed my way to the front table, quickly introduced myself. Needless to say, I never made it skiing, and I stayed almost 2 weeks there to enjoy what was going on. It was truly an amazing time. As most of you know, the result of that remarkable conference were two WIPO treaties, the WPPT, the WIPO Phonogram and Performance Treaty, and the WCT, the WIPO Copyright Treaty, which were ratified and enacted into law in the U.S. in 1998 as part of the DMCA. Shira has also spent significant time as both an academic and as a practicing IP lawyer. She was a tenured associate professor of law in Washington, D.C. at the Columbia School of Law at Catholic University, teaching there for 5 years. She also served as a litigation associate at two of New York's most prestigious IP litigation firms for a total of over 7 years. She has written and lectured widely in both the U.S. and abroad on a variety of copyright and IP topics. She has served on the editorial board of our own distinguished Journal of the Copyright Society of the USA, which she has also graced with a number of her own articles. Most impressively, her writings have been cited by the U.S. Supreme Court in at least two decisions that I'm aware of, Eldred and Golan. And as if that were not enough, she's at work on her second textbook on international and comparative copyright law. She's truly, truly a 21st century Renaissance woman, an architect of U.S. international IP policy with a very unique perspective and an important voice to be heard. Shira, as I think you know, I have the privilege of working with one of your old boyfriends, Penn Law School, and I took the liberty of asking him whether he might provide me with just a couple of personal vignettes, obviously G-rated because I know your parents are here tonight. So he thought for a moment, and he said to me, "Well, you know, she got a perfect score on the LSAT. She's a phenomenally gifted, classically trained vocalist, and her brother is a Nobel laureate in physics." To which I said to Jeff, "And she dated you, why?" And he said at the time, "I had a bike. Chicks love bikes." Go figure. So anyway, congratulations, Mr. and Mrs. Perlmutter, for making the rest of us parents feel completely inadequate here tonight. But it is my honor to present to you our 43rd annual Donald C. Brace Lecturer, Shira Perlmutter.
Well, thanks, Joe, for a truly wonderful introduction. I feel like my life just flashed before my eyes, and I'm not sure that my speech can compete with that fantastic beginning. I do want to say I am honored and very grateful for the invitation from the Copyright Society to speak here tonight, and also to Fordham for providing the venue. And I do want to start with a disclaimer. I am speaking today as an individual observer and participant in the past 20 years of copyright policy discussions, not as a public official. My remarks are the outgrowth of my checkered past that you've heard about, having had the opportunity to view the debates from a wide variety of perspectives, including the private and public sectors in the U.S. and also internationally. Copyright is on everyone's lips today. Conferences are organized, papers are published, hearings are held, blogs are posted, and bills are introduced. Copyright issues make the headlines and provide material for cocktail party chatter. The viability of copyright in the internet age and the glitches in online licensing are hot topics. But all of this activity and all of this noise in recent years has not led to the adoption of new laws. So why the disconnect between the level of interest and the pace of legislative change? The fact is that copyright policymaking in both the international and domestic spheres has become increasingly difficult. It is marked by periods of near paralysis, and I added the word near at the last minute, as debates rage, but little gets done. Of course, one could take the perspective that no action is a good thing, that gridlock, as in the larger political arena, can be preferable to foolhardy change. In the copyright field, however, the law has always been bound to technology in its definitions and in its application. And as technology evolves, so must copyright policy. This doesn't mean that copyright rights should forever expand or that change is a goal in itself, but rather the balance struck as to the scope of rights and exceptions and their practical application needs to adapt to the delivery mechanisms of the current age. In fact, as everyone here is aware, there have been growing calls for copyright reform, culminating this year in the Register of Copyright's vision of the next great Copyright Act and the congressional response through a phased review of the current act's provisions. The past decade's record, however, does not inspire optimism. While numerous proposals have been made to update copyright law, most have failed to move forward. It has always been true that many bills are introduced that don't make it into law, but the tally lately has been particularly dismal. For a combination of reasons, it seems far easier for copyright legislation to be blocked than it was in the past. I'll begin by reviewing the rise and fall of norm setting in the digital age, then try to diagnose the multiple causes that have contributed to this arc, and conclude by venturing a few prescriptions for moving forward. So to begin by outlining the problem. Digital copyright reform had its heyday from the mid-1990s through the first few years of this century. It was a very productive 10 years. A flurry of international and national activity addressed the challenges posed for copyright by emerging digital technologies. These developments are described in detail in the Green Paper on Copyright Policy, Creativity, and Innovation in the Digital Economy that we recently released in the Department of Commerce. The flurry began in this country with a 1995 publication of a prior administration report, Intellectual Property and the National Information Infrastructure, a name that sounds very quaint to 21st century ears. That report kicked off what can be called the first tranche of digital copyright reform. It provided a comprehensive overview of domestic and international copyright law and made a number of recommendations for change, many of which did end up being adopted. One such proposal joined administration support to a long-standing Copyright Office recommendation for the creation of a public performance right in sound recordings, bringing them to parity with other categories of works and with treatment in other countries, in most other countries. Just a few months after the report's publication, Congress enacted a limited version of such a public performance right, extending only to certain digital performances. As explained in the legislative history, this was based on the prediction that digital transmission of sound recordings was likely to become a very important outlet for the performance of recorded music in the near future. How prescient. This U.S. legislation was soon followed by the WIPO Internet Treaties of 1996, which were intended to update the leading multilateral copyright treaties, the Berne and Rome Conventions, for the digital age. Their provisions, which included clarification of the scope of rights, flexibility for digital exceptions, and groundbreaking protection for technological adjuncts to rights, were widely hailed as balanced. They were framed in broad and general terms, however, leaving considerable leeway to national law. In the US, it took nearly 2 years to carve out acceptable compromises. a period that seemed interminable at the time, but now looks remarkably swift. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, was enacted in 1998, in fact, 15 years ago last week. Congress didn't stop with treaty implementation, however. It was considerably more ambitious. The DMCA was an extensive piece of legislation. It included a separate title, establishing safe harbors for internet service providers, as well as updates to the library exception and to music licensing provisions. The same month saw the controversial extension of copyright term to life plus 70. Additional work on exceptions followed. In 2002, the Copyright Act was updated to facilitate digital distance education. In 2004, the Chafee Amendment expanded permissible uses of copyrighted works for the benefit of the blind and visually impaired. And in 2005, the library exception was expanded again to allow greater use of orphan works, while the Family Home Movie Act added an exemption allowing the skipping of objectionable content in motion pictures. A busy 10 years. Since then, the pace of technological change has only increased, but the pace of legislative change has stalled. So let's look at the major areas of stagnation, starting at WIPO and moving through US legislative initiatives relating to broadcasting rights, music licensing, library uses, orphan works, and enforcement. At the international level, the treaty updating process begun at WIPO in 1996 then ground to a halt for 10 years. For a number of reasons, half of the group of beneficiaries of the Rome Convention, audiovisual performers and broadcasters, had been put off for later attention. The expectation was that they would be swiftly added to the international digital acquis. Yet, a 2000 diplomatic conference to update the rights of audiovisual performers ended in failure, leading to recriminations and blame. More than a decade was to pass before the blockage could be dissolved and a treaty concluded. And broadcasting organizations, which had been pressing for updated rights since the 1990s, are still waiting their turn at WIPO's Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights, the SCCR. It remains to be seen whether the proposals on the table for their benefit will ripen into a treaty in the near future. At the domestic level in the US, there have been many recent efforts to amend copyright law to update it for 21st century needs, proposing new rights or exceptions, new structures for music licensing, or new online enforcement tools. Those efforts have not gone far. Post-2005 statutory amendments have taken place, but they have modified the specifics of existing statutory licenses and adjusted sanctions, or they've involved technical corrections. The Pro-IP Act in 2008 created the position of the IP Enforcement Coordinator in the White House and improved existing enforcement capabilities of the government, but did not address the online enforcement challenges. Although various substantive bills have been introduced during this period, none has been successful. And this is true even where there was careful preparatory work, months of intensive negotiation, wide support garnered from many sides, and agreement reached on most of the bill's provisions. So, to go through a specific list, in the area of music, there has been continued pressure to create a broadcasting right for sound recordings. Such a right has been supported by the Copyright Office as well as the administration from as early as the 1970s. Now that digital services are required to pay for the use of sound recordings, the lack of any payment obligation by over-the-air broadcasters leads to a competitive imbalance. Bills have repeatedly been introduced to address this imbalance, but none has passed. As a result, while services continue to evolve, the law has stood still. Complaints about the complexity and difficulty of music licensing, as applied to musical works, and the inhibiting effect on new online business models have been rife for at least 15 years. Among the problems usually cited are the work-specific nature of the mechanical license and the fact that the different rights in musical compositions are administered by different entities. There has been much discussion of potential reforms, but little action in the legislative arena. What progress has been made has been achieved through private negotiation, most notably a 2012 agreement on mechanical royalty rates among music publishers, record companies, and digital services, establishing that non-interactive streaming implicates only the public performance right, not the reproduction right, and adopting a formula to avoid double dipping in the case of other types of services. Attempts have also been made to further update the library exception. The DMCA amended this exception in 1998 to allow libraries and archives to take advantage of digital technologies when engaging in preservation activities. By 2006, however, there was concern that the amendments had been outstripped by technological change in a number of respects. The Copyright Office convened an independent study group to examine these issues, which issued a report in 2008 making a number of legislative recommendations. Not one of these recommendations has yet been acted upon. Another legislative proposal involved a new exception addressing the problem of orphan works, those copyrighted works whose owners cannot be identified or located, making it impossible to negotiate terms for their use. This issue has been a topic of increased concern and attention since the abandonment of copyright formalities and the extension of copyright terms. There are simply more older works and works without clear indicia of ownership that are protected by copyright. In a thorough and thoughtful report in 2006, the Copyright Office recommended a legislative solution based on limiting remedies against good faith users of orphan works. A bill was introduced in 2006 and again in 2008 that built on those recommendations. Again, ultimately, it did not pass, despite considerable interest and very broad support. The Copyright Office returned to this issue this past year with a notice of inquiry calling for public comments. And finally, the area of enforcement. Now, this has unexpectedly become the hotspot of copyright policy making. One would have thought, and I once did, that enforcement would be easy compared to rights and exceptions. Once agreement is reached on an appropriate balance in the law, how could anyone object to ensuring that that balance can be meaningfully enforced? At the international level, then, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA, seemed like a great idea. A coalition of the willing, countries with high-quality enforcement regimes, would come together and adopt a framework for gold standard enforcement procedures that could serve as a model elsewhere in the world. But nothing is simple, and nothing these days is free from controversy. Criticisms of lack of transparency and fears of enforcement excesses, some based on inaccurate reporting of the agreement's actual content, led to public protests in several European capitals. Although most participants did sign the agreement, the EU Parliament roundly rejected it in a vote of 39 in favor and 478 against. And this despite a legal committee determination that the provisions were fully consistent with existing EU law. And then, of course, in Washington, a desire to address rampant online infringement led to the introduction of bills targeting what have been called rogue websites. In 2011, the Protect IP Act introduced in the Senate and the Stop Online Piracy, or SOPA, introduced in the House would have provided for expanded government and private enforcement actions to block websites devoted to piracy. These provisions, as everyone knows, provoked strong opposition with unprecedented online activism from individuals, companies, and civil society. Although the bills also contained other provisions that were not similarly targeted, given the vehemence of the response, ultimately both bills were withdrawn. And it's generally accepted in Washington that the atmosphere at this point is not conducive to reintroducing similar enforcement legislation. So that's where we stand. That was the arc up and the arc down. My analysis is primarily directed, as you'll have heard already, toward the situation in the U.S. and at the international level. The situation may be less dire at national level elsewhere, where some of the factors that I'll identify may not yet be fully felt. In Asia, in Latin America, and in parts of Europe, legislation has indeed moved forward during this same time period. It seems likely, however, that the problem will spread. Already, I think we are seeing this effect, at least in the area of enforcement legislation. In a number of countries where there has been online enforcement legislation passed, after passage, the law has been cut back or simply not been implemented. So, for example, in the UK, the 2010 Digital Economy Act contained provisions on both website blocking and also graduated response, which needed to be implemented through regulation. To date, no regulations have been issued with respect to website blocking. This is after 3 years. And the first graduated response notices are not expected to be sent until 2015, 5 years after the law's passage. In France, the groundbreaking Adopi legislation, which first established a graduated response model, has been amended to remove the sanction of account termination, leaving the possibility of fines. And at EU level, the review of the enforcement directive announced in 2011 so far appears to have led nowhere. So that's where we stand. And now to try to diagnose the factors that have led to this state of impasse. These factors are many, and they've been the subject of considerable comment before. Each of them, I would say, has positive aspects, but nevertheless has served to slow policy development. They range from the impact of international trade negotiations and development concerns to the expansion of the number and variety of voices joining the public debate, to the impact of new technology on process and timing, as well as on substance. On the international side, we've seen the intertwining of copyright and trade, which started in the 1990s. On the one hand, this has led to the adoption of modern copyright laws in countries around the world and enhanced substantive harmonization. In this sense, trade interests have served as an engine for copyright reform. Whether or not one approves of the specific changes, it is undeniable that there has been movement. On the other hand, the trade connection has also meant a more contentious and less flexible negotiating environment in the separate context of pure IP norm setting. At WIPO, for example, concerns about positions in contemporaneous trade negotiations have led to demands for redundant text or refusals to accept long-established treaty norms. In the June 2013 Marrakesh diplomatic conference, least developed countries were unwilling to take on any new obligations to apply the three-step test for copyright exceptions because they had just obtained an extension to the moratorium on their TRIPS obligations, and TRIPS contains a version of that test. Other delegations were clearly conscious of how the shaping of the provision on technological measures could affect ongoing negotiations of the same issue in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Another factor internationally has been the rise of the so-called development agenda at WIPO and elsewhere. Developing countries have taken the position that development goals should always inform IP debates, particularly at WIPO as a UN-affiliated agency. The focus on development implications necessarily entails consideration of topics beyond the specific technical IP issues on the table. And while development goals are, of course, important in their own right, this too serves to complicate policymaking. In terms of process, there have been a number of interesting factors. The community of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, has been increasingly empowered with greater participation in international forums. This is not simply a question of sheer numbers or size, The nature of the NGO voice has also changed. We now see the involvement of public interest groups that work on a global stage, whether through physical offices, travel, or virtual networks. Unlike in the past, these groups do not necessarily represent interests that take part in the day-to-day operation of the copyright system. This means that the debates become more ideological, with practical solutions perhaps less available. At both the national and international levels, the copyright value chain has become more complex. Now, what do I mean by that? There are more players with different stakes to defend and more intermediaries operating in the space between creators and consumers. Rather than the classic model of creators offering their works to publishers and producers who then offer them to the public, a host of new players, such as technology companies, online services, and internet service providers, all play a role in the online ecosystem. And multiple alternative distribution options are available, potentially cutting out traditional intermediaries completely. In other words, the landscape we copyright lawyers once operated in is shifting under our feet. And critically, consumers themselves have become a significant voice to be reckoned with. Of course, consumer desires have always shaped the market as right holders sought an audience for their works. But today, consumers are more than a passive audience. They have the potential to be creators in their own right more than ever before, users on a scale that can impact the market for a work, and global distributors. Technology has empowered them in new ways, and they are newly aware of how their lives are affected by copyright. Moreover, they have alternative means of access available to them that didn't exist in the past, and they need to be convinced to participate in the legitimate marketplace. They need to be wooed. In part as a result of all of these changes, internet activism has entered the copyright policy space. The most prominent examples are the public campaigns in opposition to SOPA and Protect IP in the US and to ACTA in the EU. Their success can be attributed both to the existence of well-organized international networks of activists and to the technological capacity of online communications. Messages can be delivered overnight in huge numbers, overwhelming policymakers. The positive aspect is the unprecedented ability to hear the voice of the people directly, increasing democracy. The negative aspect is the danger that the messages may not be adequately informed or nuanced, and typically they transmit concerns rather than supporting solutions. Most of all, the high volume and the immediacy leaves little room for discussion or improvement. This is an issue today not just for copyright, but for any legislation in the internet sphere. And the challenge is how to get input from the full range of the public, including the individual creator as well as the consumer, in a helpful way, free from the heat of the moment, that can take into account the long-term impact of policy proposals as well as their immediate effect. The IP debates generally have also been marked by greater politicization. The stakes have been raised, with the discourse moved above the level of technical experts and with political facets added. World leaders have become personally involved on a number of high-profile issues, from President Obama's concern about so-called patent trolls to President Hollande of France running on a platform of reform of Adobe, to then-President Medvedev's warnings in Russia about copyright being out of date. The last decade has even seen the rise of a political party founded on anti-copyright principles. The Pirate Party in Europe has achieved far more prominence than might have been expected for what started as a single-issue movement, although it now seems to be on the wane. And at the same time, the rapidity of technological and market change poses a challenge for the normal slow pace of legislation. A law may take years to enact and be largely outdated by the time it takes effect, at which point, of course, it cannot easily be changed. The ISP safe harbors of the DMCA were constructed in 1998 to address then-current forms of online dissemination. Only 1 year later, They were challenged by the unforeseen technology of peer-to-peer file sharing. Again, this is not a copyright-specific problem, but it does have a major effect on copyright law. And calls for data-driven policymaking are hard to satisfy in such a fast-moving environment where the best study may be stale before its conclusions are acted upon. Finally, digital technology itself creates growing overlap with other areas of the law, notably communications and privacy. So copyright decisions may have serious implications for those fields as well. For example, the most recent DMCA rulemaking raised questions about telecommunications policy with respect to consumer unlocking of cell phones, an issue that, as the Library of Congress has noted, is not well suited to be addressed through copyright. So all of this complexity is quite daunting, and the question is whether and how anything can still be accomplished. So if you're not too depressed, I will try to talk about what can be done. And of course, prescriptions are always harder than diagnoses. Now, there have in fact been a few green shoots in all of this desert, some areas of forward movement where paralysis has been broken. So let's look at them and try to see what made them possible. At WIPO, starting last year, the international community moved forward after the 10-year hiatus I described and finally adopted two new copyright treaties, the Beijing Treaty on Audiovisual Performances and the Marrakesh Treaty for the Blind and Visually Impaired. The U.S. has also continued to conclude bilateral trade agreements, several of them in those fallow years between 2005 and 2012. Domestically, progress has been made by the private sector in seeking ways to curb online piracy. These include voluntary cross-industry initiatives, such as the 2007 Principles for User-Generated Content Services and the 2011 Copyright Alert System, addressing infringement over peer-to-peer file-sharing networks. Other industries, notably online payment processors and advertising networks, have adopted sets of best practices to address websites dedicated to piracy. In addition, individual companies, ranging from digital advertising services to credit card companies and search engines, have put in place their own programs aimed at curbing infringement. The jury is still out on how effective each of these initiatives may be, and the PTO is currently examining ways in which their impact can be measured. And then finally, last but not least, the DMCA's triennial Library of Congress rulemakings have continued to establish exceptions to the prohibition on circumventing technical measures that protect copyrighted works. So what were the factors that allowed progress in each of these areas? Several, at least, can be identified, perhaps best summarized as directed self-interest. The treaty negotiations dealt with subject matter of clear mutual interest. There were comparable stakes for all delegations, or if not comparable, even higher for developing countries. All countries have actors whose rights they would like to see protected when their performances are exploited abroad. All countries have significant populations of the visually impaired and a desire to provide them with better access to books. For each negotiator, there was a perception of meaningful stakes and worthwhile trade-offs. While some of these trade-offs may have involved larger political or economic goals that did not relate specifically to the treaty's coverage, those goals were generally able to be sacrificed at the late stages of negotiations in order to achieve an acceptable outcome. In addition, there was clear public legitimacy in benefiting the classes to be protected with support from all sides, including civil society, and of course, political downsides for governments in being blamed for failure. Finally, negotiations were eased by the fact that the treaty provisions were narrow in scope, by and large building on already established norms. The bilateral trade agreements continue to be driven by the impetus of economic benefits for the U.S. as well as for our trading partners. And while some of the IP provisions in the FTAs have been controversial, the copyright chapters are based on established U.S. law, and the trade-offs they have entailed have certainly not derailed progress. As to the voluntary initiatives, there has been growing pressure, commercial and otherwise, to find solutions allowing the legitimate marketplace to flourish. Right holders and intermediaries of all types are increasingly aware of their interlocking and overlapping self-interests, not least of all due to more intermediaries becoming producers or distributors of content in their own right. What has brought them to the tipping point, though, of taking action in these particular cases? Well, concern about potential liability or a desire to forestall legislation has often served as a goad, as has strong government encouragement, notably from the Office of the IP Enforcement Coordinator. And not to be overlooked, again, is the factor of public legitimacy. According to judging from recent surveys, substantial majorities of consumers do believe that copyright should be respected and creators should be compensated, rather than subscribing to the rhetoric that predominates on many blogs. And finally, the DMCA rulemaking. It's interesting, this relies on a statutory framework for regulating the development of norms outside the constraints of the legislative process. This not only permits, but in fact requires progress to be made at regular intervals. So, what are the lessons we can take from these successes? Well, a number of copyright policy initiatives are currently pending in the U.S. and internationally. These include the Congressional Review of the Copyright Act, the various topics currently being examined by the Copyright Office and by the Department of Commerce as an outgrowth of the Green Paper, and the items on the agenda of the WIPO Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights. What can be done to move forward on these or future issues? And how do we define policy progress? In my view, progress is not necessarily norm setting through legislation or treaty. It can be achieved through soft law at the international level, such as recommendations or agreed principles, or through cooperative initiatives such as TIGER, the proposed system facilitated by WIPO for cross-border exchange of accessible format copies of books for the visually impaired. Nationally, progress could be made through administrative regulation, through cross-sectoral agreements, model codes or best practices, corporate policies, new business models, or changes in public perception. These developments don't occur in a vacuum. Each may in turn affect the others. Public perception, for example, may shift in response to government statements, business behavior, or the nature of available market offerings. Now, legislative solutions do have several drawbacks. First, as I noted earlier, they take time. Once adopted, they're difficult to change, and they tend to be technology-specific, allowing them to be outmoded quickly. In today's environment, as we've seen, copyright bills are easy to demonize and easy to block. And legislation can be harder to internationalize than other approaches, given differences in political and legal contexts in other countries and the additional hurdles of international policymaking. Nevertheless, there will always be areas where binding norm setting is necessary. This is true, for example, in cases of market failure, as represented in the U.S. by at least some exceptions, as well as compulsory licenses, although the market failure of one era may give way to market solutions in another. Legislation is needed to establish the boundaries of property rights. Criminal enforcement and judicial interpretation clearly require legislative empowerment. And voluntary agreements themselves at some point may need legislative backup, as on their own, they cannot bind outliers, and they may lead to competitive disadvantages or be barred by antitrust concerns. And at the international level, there's another factor. The provision of benefits through national treatment or reciprocity needs a public law basis. So, for example, recent private agreements by some companies to provide compensation for the broadcasting of sound recordings may not be sufficient to trigger reciprocal payments to U.S. performers of royalties collected in other countries. So, what prescriptions can I offer? There are no panaceas, but I do think there are some prescriptions that may help ease the path and enable some movement. and they are based on principles of incrementalism, pragmatism, directed self-interest, and public legitimacy. First, I think the best way to make progress is often to do so incrementally and to take advantage of any technique that's available. Where there's an urgent problem or an immediate result is within reach, we should seize the opportunity. It is worth moving forward in small steps. This doesn't mean ruling out packages and trade-offs where they may be useful. So an example in the international arena is the proposed WIPO broadcasting treaty. This treaty, which is aimed at updating the rights of broadcasting organizations, has been under discussion for more than 20 years. The original proposals were modeled on the WPPT, providing for a set of exclusive rights with flexibility for exceptions. Discussions have taken place for years about the appropriate scope of the treaty as different negotiators come and go, particularly with respect to new online services and uses. After the General Assembly narrowed the proposed scope of coverage to traditional broadcasters and cablecasters and to signal-based piracy, debate has continued as to what exactly this means. Divergent proposals remain on the table. And in order to break the logjam, the U.S. has now suggested a greatly scaled-back approach, providing a single core right that would address the central concerns of broadcasters without creating an additional layer of rights at the international level. This would not provide everything that broadcasters want or match the level of protection already available in some jurisdictions, but it would avoid many pitfalls and concerns. We should focus on the art of the possible. Similarly, the conclusion of the Marrakesh Treaty would not have been possible had countries not agreed to separate out the issue of improved access to printed materials for the visually impaired from the broader range of exceptions and limitations and the issue of other types of disabilities. Second prescription, legislation will sometimes but not always be the best solution. We should be pragmatic in accepting any approach that can make a difference. This may be particularly true in the areas of enforcement and licensing, but it applies in other contexts as well. The Section 1201 rulemaking has permitted more flexible responses to changed circumstances than legislation ever could. Elsewhere in the DMCA, problems have been raised over the years about the operation of the notice and takedown system. ISPs and right holders alike have found aspects of the system burdensome in various ways. While changes to the law could alleviate those problems, the system could also be significantly improved through agreements among its users on how they operate. And the Department of Commerce Green Paper therefore proposes the establishment of a stakeholders forum to develop a code of conduct toward that end. Third, as we've seen, a key to making progress is to identify and draw on mutual self-interest with movement sparked by outside pressure. The copyright alert system, negotiated at length among major ISPs and right holder groups and supported by the administration, illustrates the potential for this type of positive development. And fourth, the path can be eased and pitfalls avoided by developing public legitimacy for policy goals. In an era of heightened public involvement and attention, this may be essential for meaningful results. Education and outreach efforts can lead to broader acceptance of proposed changes and minimize irrational reactions. So what does this mean for the role of government? It is surely evolving, but it will remain critical. Going forward, the most effective role is likely to be as an enabler and a facilitator. Legislation will always provide a framework, but rather than the detailed codes that already exist in parts of the Copyright Act, something less prescriptive may be more useful in many circumstances. This can allow regulators, the private sector, and the public to put in place appropriate, flexible, and changeable mechanisms that operate against the backdrop of the law. The government also has the ability to act as a source of pressure, whether through the bully pulpit or the threat of taking action. This role has led to constructive results in the development of the DMCA safe harbors, in developing a U.S. position for the Beijing Performances Treaty, and in the development of voluntary initiatives. Even the convening of meetings where participants are asked to work together can lead to better communication and cooperation. And in addition to these functions, we cannot forget that the government serves as a guarantor of the public interest. It has the responsibility to ensure that public policy goals, including transparency and due process, are adequately respected as compromises are carved out among stakeholders. Pragmatism does not mean that important values can be neglected. And equally important may be the government's role as a data provider and as a neutral arbiter. This is especially true in this country, given the special role of the Copyright Office in its registration and recordation functions, as well as its administration of royalty systems. Additional service may be provided in the future through the office's newly proposed small claims procedure. These roles will likely increase in value as online licensing becomes more and more prevalent. And while the private sector is already taking steps to provide comprehensive databases and licensing platforms, the government may be able to speed the development of links and interoperability among the different creative sectors and jurisdictions. Over the past 2 years, for example, the UK government has engaged stakeholders in a process of analyzing the gaps in the online marketplace and has fostered the establishment of a copyright hub to facilitate online licensing. The Green Paper poses the question of whether this or any other role for the US government would be advisable, and if so, how it should be structured. We look forward to receiving input on these issues. So, to conclude, the copyright policy debates will never be easy in the complex and fast-changing environment we live in, subject to so much public scrutiny. But gradual progress is happening, it's beginning to happen, and it should continue if we are creative in finding solutions. As the focus increasingly shifts from detailed legislation to a mix of flexible governmental and private sector approaches, and the online marketplace becomes more mature, we can hope to see the level of acrimony subside. And in my view, a strong dose of pragmatism can significantly improve the health of the copyright policy environment. Thank you.
You mentioned the next great Copyright Act being favored by the Copyright Office. I wonder what you feel, or how you feel about its, or at least the Register's expression favoring the reintroduction of formalities and or their strengthening. These seem to include requiring a new registration to be taken out at the end of the 50 years of a post-mortem term. And if the owner does register the copyright, they have the extra 20 years. But that would serve to shorten the term of copyright, certainly for most Europeans. And formalities and registration, as we know, are counter to the Berne Convention, which eschews formalities. And the other thing that the Register seems to favor, and she has mentioned this in speeches, is that transactions, significant transactions of copyright or the granting of licenses need to be registered as well. It's a totally new formality, which I find really detrimental to copyright holders. Thank you.
Well, there have been a number of calls to rethink formalities in the digital environment because of the perceived value of the of access to public information about the ownership of rights. And there certainly is a lot of value in it. At the same time, you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that we have a structure of international treaties that ban the imposition of formalities on the enjoyment or exercise of rights. So what I see as the best way forward, because even if one were to accept the idea that abandoning formalities is a good idea, it would take, and even if it were possible to change the international treaties, it would take considerable time, probably more than 10 years, I would imagine. So it seems advisable instead to focus on how to make the provision of this information, of ownership information, to the Copyright Office and otherwise as easy and attractive as possible. So that's been the focus of our thinking in the green paper, and we support the work the Copyright Office is doing to try to improve the comprehensiveness and effectiveness of the registration and recordation systems as they exist.
Shira, to what extent do you think a possible bar to pragmatism is the fact that internet service providers do not at base have copyright as part of their interest?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the world is changing. I mean, for one thing, there are more and more intertwining corporate interests. Comcast now owns NBC Universal. Of course, in my day when I worked at Time Warner, it was AOL Time Warner, so that was also a different world. And I think there's beginning to be some breakthroughs in how these businesses are working together, that there's more of a perception that there's a need to make the entire ecosystem work on a long-term basis. So I tend to think we're moving more in a good direction, but I agree, there's still more work to be done, and that's why there's still a role for outside pressure, whether it's from government or otherwise, to try to move things in a good direction.
The Copyright Office has just sent to Congress a proposal dealing with small claims. Would you care to comment on its merits and its prospects?
Well, on prospects, I have no idea, and there are some people from the Copyright Office here, and if anyone wanted to comment on that, that would be great. I will say, you know, on the merits, I certainly think it's very important for us to find ways that individuals can enforce their rights or get appropriate results from an arbiter, from a public arbiter, and so the concept to me is a very appealing concept. We're still studying the report, and it's a 166-page report with a lot of detail. It's incredibly thoughtful and well done, and we're still at a position where we don't have a position on the substance of it, but the concept of a forum where rights can be validated is a very positive one. And I will say it also ties into some of the issues in the online environment, where we have heard from individual creators and small businesses that it's difficult for them even to use the notice and takedown system of the DMCA because it requires being able to watch everything that's happening on the internet and repeatedly serve notices.
I know you weren't really addressing like national issues. I was just curious what countries on the international scene are considered kind of the most innovative and most promising to have interesting developments in new legislation.
Do you mean on the enforcement side or?
Really, you know, rights or enforcement or?
Well, there's certainly a lot of activity in the major European countries. In addition to France and the UK, which I mentioned, Spain and Italy have seen a lot of activity in this space recently. China is in the process of revising all of their IP laws, so there's a tremendous amount of activity there. South Korea has been very active in this area, and of course Japan. And as you would expect, you tend to see a lot of activity in countries where digital technology and broadband penetration are most advanced.
This may be, I don't know if you can address this at all, but do you have any comments that you could make about the effort to create a global repertoire database for musical works and where that is going and stands and what you think the prognosis is for how that's going to work, because data in the digital music business is a huge problem, not only in being able to report, but to pay creators and content owners. So yeah. It's been a mess for a long time.
Well, it sounds like you're more up to date on it than I am, but I will say I think it's a very good idea, and you're right, you know, the availability of up-to-date, high-quality, comprehensive data is critical to be able to have good online licensing. So I've certainly seen the Global Rights Database as a very positive step forward, but I have to admit I haven't followed it that much in the last year or so, so I'm not up-to-date on the latest developments.
Is the other project, the IMR, I think it was called, the International Music Repertoire, that was involved with WIPO somehow, is that still moving forward, or is that pretty much winding down and not happening?
Yeah, well, there's two separate things. One is that it's my understanding that the recording industry is also looking at trying to develop a global database as well. I don't know exactly where that stands at present either, but WIPO itself had looked into the possibility of an international music registry, and I think what they found when they started talking to everyone in the music industry was that people felt they would prefer to have a private sector development and that they didn't trust WIPO to take that job forward. So WIPO started doing a scoping survey to see if there were ways that that could be re-envisioned to give them an appropriate role, and they were looking at issues like standards and interoperability, but it's my understanding from when I was at the General Assemblies at the end of September, beginning of October, that even that effort, the IMR, has been abandoned at this point, and WIPO is now reconceptualizing what role they might play in general in the online licensing environment, but it may not be limited to music. They haven't made any formal proposals yet, but I understand that they're having internal discussions.
Shira, to what extent, and this is domestically, but teeing off the last question, to what extent do you think there were impediments to revisions at all to the Copyright Act based on the limitations, sort of the practical limitations currently, digital practical limitations in the Copyright Office, in terms of what is out there? In terms of recordation and the inability to really fully discover and disclose what is recorded. Do you think that has any impact on any potential legislation down the road or legislative efforts?
Do you mean practical limitations because of...
Well, for instance, with orphan works. In terms of getting meaningful orphan works legislation passed, I think you need more than... Don't you need more than a fiction of being able to go to the office and research and find what has been... what's out there, what has been recorded?
Well, it's interesting. Registered. I mean, for example, in Europe, where they now have orphan works legislation at least EU level that's being implemented, they're putting in place a database of orphan works, so not just of copyrighted works, but where people can go to find works that have been deemed to be orphan, which is helpful also if you're an author who then can find out that your work has been deemed orphan and you can reclaim your rights. I think it is good public policy to have as comprehensive as possible a public database of rights ownership, and I know that the Register of Copyrights believes that too, and the office is working very hard to make the databases as comprehensive and up-to-date and easily accessible as possible. And, you know, obviously I support and my office supports very much that the office be given the resources it needs to be able to do that work.
Shira, you mentioned the Copyright Hub in the UK, and I know it's sort of questions about that are in the current request for information that's out there. What kind of appetite do you think there might be in the US government to lead an effort similar to what the UK government did?
Well, I know I found the various Hooper reports that led up to the establishment of the hub very interesting and well-written and helpful. Whether the actual hub itself will work, I don't know. And I know it was launched in July, and I don't know that much has happened or that it's made much of a difference. So I suppose the question is there something we can take from that might make sense for us to do? Perhaps a narrower, more focused version of that, or maybe there needs to be a lot more input as to other approaches that are quite different. So we're very open-minded, but I did think the reports were very interesting and useful templates for thinking about some of these issues.
I was going to suggest that given the hour and the cocktails that are waiting everybody outside, I might suggest we adjourn. And if there are further questions, I know Sherry, you'll be here, but thank you very much.
Thanks.